10. Anti-capitalism and anti-war streetworkers. The Institute for Policy Studies and its hard-left collaborators have centered their progressive socialist Marxist goals and strategies on a theory of the United States being ruled by a corporate-controlled government that is dedicated to an imperialist world military domination. While the rhetoric is nauseatingly familiar, the radical left's pivot points of attack are now aimed at fostering a transformation of American culture as a first step in bringing a progressive government to political power. In the 1990s, when the world economy began shifting toward economic globalization and the U.S. stood as the sole military superpower, the left went to work in North America, Europe, and Oceania, Australia, and New Zealand to counter American economic and military influence. The IPS director, John Kavanaugh, and Transnational Institute director, Susan George, assumed key roles in curbing U.S. global influence. Kavanaugh took responsibility for the North American radical left, while George, who was not yet the TNI director, worked with Western European socialists and Marxists. In addition to her role at TNI, Susan George was on the board of Greenpeace International from 1990 to 1994. And vice president of ATTAC France, Association for Taxation of Financial Transactions to Aid Citizens. From 1999 to 2006, which promotes taxation of international financial transactions for revenue for developmental projects in Southern Hemisphere countries. As was the case in North America, the hardline European left, as well as leftists in Oceania, turned to Antonio Gramsci to help pave the way on the path to Marxist renewal and reemergence. The anti-globalization and anti-war movements coalesced in confronting the twin devils of transnational corporations in the U.S. war on terrorism. Susan George presented the IPS/TNI and the hard left's anti-globalization, anti-capitalism baseline perspective in November 1999. During the 50,000-strong left-wing battle for Seattle, an effort to block economic ministers from around the globe from holding discussions at the World Trade Organization, WTO meeting, Dr. George stated that she thought, "We are really at war. We've got an enemy, which is the whole corporate system. The objective of that corporate system, whether financial or industrial, is to be able to go where it wants and produce what it wants, when it wants, for as long as it wants, to make as much money as it can, and damn the costs. The goal is profit, and anything that enhances that goal is good, and anything that goes against that goal is bad. If the enemy is transnational and is going for total control, then I think it's obvious that the response has also got to be transnational, and it's got to be a mix of people. We want international democracy. But if we're to get it, we've got to fight for each other. The threat is to all of us. If we're not fighting each for all for each, we're going to be picked off one by one." John Kavanaugh, IPS director, took a similarly harsh position on the U.S. war on terrorism. "The United States has taken on the role of the world's policeman, but the world is not calling 911. He argued that the United States spends way too much on the military, proposing a $213 billion cut in the 2008 military budget, including $145 billion from the world policeman accounts and $68 billion through unilateral nuclear weapons cuts and trimming Pentagon bureaucracy. The IPS view is that some of these savings can go to homeland security and human needs, a code word for progressive socialist Marxist programs designed to help transform American culture and bring the radical left to power. Ending U.S. military interventions will require a full-scale reversal of the imperial trajectory embedded so deeply in U.S. foreign policy. A just counterterrorism policy would shift the focus away from military solutions and focus on strengthening homeland security and the international mechanisms that hold terrorists accountable. Fear is the greatest weapon of terrorists. When it becomes our greatest weapon, too, what does that make us?" By late 2002, the anti-capitalist and anti-war movements persuaded thousands of unsuspecting Americans to support the hard-left activists conducting civil disobedience protests in the streets of North America and Europe. Following the IPS/TNI position that terrorist action was a law-breaking event that required a law enforcement response rather than a military one, radical leftist organizations built influential anti-globalization and anti-war quasi-realities. All of this was about the Gramsci's insistence upon raising issues necessary to destroy bourgeois society. IPS member Karl Boggs writes in Gramscized Marxism that the transition to socialism would not follow a fixed path, but would respond to the socialist politics and place human actors at the center of the revolutionary process. Gramsci was adamant that socialist revolution would not come mechanically from the breakdown of the capitalist economy, but would have to be built, that is, one through purposive human action within a wide range of historical settings. Street workers ranged all the way from bored college students seeking a little excitement to hard-bitten anarchists, socialists, and Marxists hiding under the progressive label. Direct action included peaceful demonstrations, property damage against capitalist businesses, and physical challenges against public safety officers. Propaganda reinforcing the impact of violence and property destruction were often accompanied by puppets, large banners, signs, buttons, handbills, posters, newspapers, and other written materials. Chants by protesters, "Whose streets? Our streets," provided a sense of solidarity in sticking it to the man. In the final analysis, anti-capitalism and anti-war were two sides of the same coin, only the propaganda themes differed. The protests were all about political power, building a viable anti-capitalist movement and fostering Marxist renewal and re-emergence. Each anti-globalization and anti-war protest from 1999 through 2008 developed its own personality as derived from the mix of radical left groups and street workers on the scene. These protests, in the main, were propaganda and disinformation events staged by the Institute for Policy Studies and Transnational Institute and their shining stars in the whole solar system of organizations. The torrent of deceit and deception used by the radical left savaged the Bush administration, whose response, one must admit, was pitiful. The anti-capitalist and anti-war campaigns were always about undermining the U.S. government and Americans' leaders, while calling for change in time for the 2008 presidential election. Operating under close ties with the Shadow Party, inside the Democrat Party, the Institute for Policy Studies prepared the political battlefield for the 2008 presidential candidate Barack Obama by sponsoring and preparing the anti-capitalism and anti-Iraq War Street protests. Anti-capitalism. The coin of the realm for anti-capitalists is direct action and propaganda, or agitprop. Drawn from the parlance of the former Soviet Union, direct action is designed to stir up emotions at major demonstrations against the imperialists, the United States in particular, while propaganda, selected truth, works on the minds of the capitalists. The aim is to combine language to stimulate emotional and intellectual reactions in order to motivate and guide direct action against capitalism. The political messages are designed to build an ever stronger movement against the free market and sovereignty itself. Direct action and propaganda promote the radical left's utopian revolutionary vision of world socialist governance. The People's Global Action, PGA, was established in Geneva in February 1998 to carry red, socialist Marxist, red and black, anarcho-communist, and green, environmental/anti-corporate banners forward in the 21st century. Three of the most important PGA creators in Geneva were Mexico's Marxist Zapatistas, Brazil's Landless Peasants Movement, Movimento Sem Terra, and India's Karnataka State Farmers Union. These three groups became members of the first PGA conveners, or leadership committee. Among the 300 delegates from 71 countries meeting in Geneva to give birth to the PGA were the Canadian Postal Workers Union, Earth First, Korean Trade Union, Reclaim the Streets, Britain, and the Women's Network of North America. Others present included representatives of radical anti-nuclear groups, French farmers, and indigenous peoples' organizations from around the world. The People's Global Action decided at its second conference, held in Bangalore, India in August 1999, to broaden the scope of its direct action and propaganda from an almost exclusive opposition to capitalist institutions and treaties, especially the World Trade Organization, World Bank, and International Monetary Fund, to the social and environmental issues created by global corporate activities. At the same time, the PGA extended its reach to the South through links between indigenous peoples' movements and other groups alleged to have had their lives worsened by transnational corporations and their enabling institutions in the North. At its core, the International People's Global Action is made up of anti-globalization socialists, communists, anarchists, and Gramscian Marxists, including a strong syndicalist or union cadre. Its outreach extends to countries in the Southern Hemisphere, the South, consisting of numerous social and cultural groups. Another strong cadre within the PGA provides a core of urban street fighters dedicated to revolutionary change and worker control. Anarcho-syndicalism fights private enterprise and state control alike, Albert Meltzer, a leading anarchist syndicalist, explained in 1996. Its aim is to abolish both. Some of these groups describe themselves as anarcho-communists. The PGA's conference at Cochabamba, Bolivia, in late September 2001 went off track from the beginning. Because of the disruption of air traffic following the September 11th terrorist attacks, only one American and three Canadian delegates were able to reach Cochabamba. Bolivia refused visas to all African delegates, except those from South Africa. Activists from Asia arrived days late or were refused entry, and 40 Latin American delegates in a bus caravan that passed through Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru were prevented from entering Bolivia at the border. In the end, some 150 to 200 foreign delegates did not make the meeting. Nonetheless, about 175 foreign delegates managed to join more than 100 Bolivian militants for the PGA session. The PGA conclave was hosted by the Cinco Federaciones del Trópico de Cochabamba, five federations of cocoa growers of the Tropic of Cochabamba. This farmers' union, later with six federations, served as a powerful voice and action group for the cocaleros or coca bush growers that fueled the cocaine traffic. PGA propaganda frequently used a cocalera named Leonida, a Bolivian farmer, who wailed a well-rehearsed tune of a Bolivian tradition of coca leaf chewing to ward off hunger, and Hayu.S.-funded spraying of coca crops also damaged the gardens planted alongside coca fields by peaceful peasants. "The coca spray turned bananas black," she told me. Among the groups participating from the South in the fall of 2001 PGA conference in Cochabamba were India's National Alliance of People's Movements, Mexico's National Liberation Army, Zapatistas, Colombia's Proceso de Comunidades Negras, Black Communities Process, Brazil's Movimento Sem Terra, Landless Peasants Movements, Indian groups located in Latin American countries, and new urban movements in Argentina and Brazil. The International Marxist Renewal and Reemergence, represented by the People's Global Action, declared its revolutionary hallmarks or philosophy at the Cochabamba Conference. These hallmarks declared war against the capitalist West. 1. A very clear rejection of capitalism, imperialism, and feudalism, all trade agreements, institutions, and governments that promote destructive globalization. 2. We reject all forms and systems of domination and discrimination, including, but not limited to, patriarchy, racism, and religious fundamentalism of all creeds. We embrace the full dignity of all human beings. 3. A confrontational attitude, since we do not think that lobbying can have a major impact in such biased and undemocratic organizations, in which transnational capital is the only real policymaker. 4. A call to direct action and civil disobedience, support for social movement struggles, advocating forms of resistance which maximize respect for life and oppressed people's rights, as well as the construction of local alternatives to global capitalism. 5. An organizational philosophy based on decentralization and autonomy. Meanwhile, some anti-war groups, such as Britain's Committee for Nuclear Disarmament, were retooling their anti-globalization focus to merge it with their opposition to a possible United States response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Protest target, World Trade Organization, WTO. Organized and guided by the ultra-left, some 50,000 people, from apple-cheeked college students dressed in turtle costumes to grizzled, no-nonsense union workers, gathered in Seattle in late 1999 with one clear objective: to stop some 5,000 trade ministers and delegates from the 135 member countries and 35 observer states from conducting business at the World Trade Organization conference. International leftists based their protest on the premise that the WTO was atop a structure of global governance in which transnational corporations exerted influence over sovereign governments. The key assumption holding up this shaky action plank was that transnational corporations were preventing governments of industrialized countries from exercising democratic control over their economies. In this way, the ultra-left claimed, the sovereign right and authority of the people to shape their own lives was being hijacked by giant corporations through the WTO. Power to the people, the protesters screamed in Seattle, echoing Jane Fonda's anti-American shouts in the early 1970s. The IPS spin-off, International Forum on Globalization, IFG, set the stage of the anti-WTO violence and protests in Seattle in a 1999 report that described the World Trade Organization as an invisible government in clear radical left terms. The central operating principle of the WTO is that global commercial interests, actually, the interests of global corporations, should always supersede all others. Any obstacles to the smooth operation and rapid expansion of global corporate activity should be suppressed. In practice, however, these obstacles are national, provincial, and state and community laws and standards that are made on behalf of labor rights, environmental protection, human rights, consumer rights, local culture, social justice, national sovereignty, and democracy. Such standards of nations are viewed by the WTO and global corporations as impediments to free trade, when they are actually national expressions of democratic processes within individual countries that reflect local values, cultures, and interests. The IFG, representing more than 60 organizations in 25 countries in 1999, became the steel teeth in the jaws of the anti-globalization movement. An IPS spin-off, the IFG masked its board of directors from direct public view. Collectively, however, the board and associate directors shrouded by the world's shadows provided the driving force behind the anti-globalization movement. IFG Board of Directors. Maud Barlow, Council of Canadians. John Kavanaugh, Institute for Policy Studies. Tony Clark, Polaris Institute, Canada. Edward Goldsmith, The Ecologist, UK. Martin Kaur, Third World Network, Malaysia. Andrew Kimbrell, International Center for Technology Assessment. Jerry Mander, Public Media Center. Helena Norberg-Hodge, International Society for Ecology and Culture, UK. Mark Ritchie, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Vandana Shiva, Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Ecology, India. Lori Wallach, Public Citizen. Associate Directors selected. Walden Bello, Focus on Global South, Thailand. Brent Blackwelder, Friends of the Earth. Kevin Danaher, Global Exchange. Randall Hayes, Rainforest Action Network. David Corton, People-Centered Development Forum. The ultra-left's direct action propaganda campaign against the WTO in Seattle was divided into four steps. 1. Strategic preparation. Identify corporation-government collusion that denies the people's democratic rights. 2. Strategic focus, establish campaign priorities and objectives by exposing how the target corporation is undermining the people's democratic rights. 3. Strategic action, take direct action, such as boycotts, labor strikes, protests, to mobilize public pressure on the government to withdraw its support for the target corporation. And 4. Strategic change. Participate actively in global movements to create new mechanisms for governments to exercise control over transnational corporations in ways that will preserve the people's democratic rights. Despite public statements to the contrary by protest leaders, street disorder, property damage, and violence were key aspects of their anti-WTO direct action tactics. Many of the radical left, environmental, and labor chieftains had worked together previously in opposing free trade initiatives. Among the top planners were labor unions affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Organization and planning from non-governmental organizations were provided by the think tank of the left, the Institute for Policy Studies, its European sister organization, the Transnational Institute, and the International Forum on Globalization, IFG, another IPSBOND entity. Other NGOs included the Ralph Nader's Public Citizen and Global Trade Watch, plus the World Development Movement, WDM, a British-based non-governmental organization that helped to organize the raucous protests in London on June 18, 1999. The Direct Action Network, DAN, served as an umbrella group in Seattle to make on-the-scene suggestions to protesters on redirecting their illegal marches en route to blocking key intersections that would prevent WTO delegates from reaching the conference center. While the Seattle police broke up large crowds, Direct Action Network organizers stepped in and redirected the protesters to blockade other cross streets, sometimes in four or five different directions, and then recombining to provide multiple human barriers. The Ruckus Society trained thousands of activists prior to anti-WDO protests in Seattle. Funded in part by CNN founder Ted Turner and the Ben & Jerry's Foundation, the Ruckus Society became the nation's boot camp for civil disobedience. Opening a college spring break training camp in Arcadia, Florida in March 2000, Ruckus offered civil disobedience training. 80 persons paid their own way and participated in the Peace River campground. The camp sponsors included the radical leftist group Rainforest Action Network, RAN, Free the Planet, a student group, and Ozone Action, a global warming activist group. The Peace Camp was another tool in the Ruckus Society's rucksack of lessons on how to break the law. Established in 1995, Ruckus is also one of the most flagrant abusers of U.S. nonprofit, tax-exempt groups. The Senate Finance Committee, as late as mid-2005, had adopted a hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil position. While the Ruckus Society and other radical left tax-exempt non-governmental groups ran amok trying to undermine the U.S. government, the Rainforest Action Network and Ruckus Society, according to non-governmental organization expert David Hogberg, are two of the biggest practitioners of so-called civil disobedience. 18 among the key street workers driving the Seattle protests were radical environmentalists in opposition to biotechnology, eco-terrorists, and the Animal Liberation Front, corporate media critics, and college-based activists against sweatshops in the developing world. Another band of rogues included a variety of communist leftovers from the Cold War and renewed Marxists. Legal services were offered to the protesters by the National Lawyers Guild and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. The Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild provided a tell-all handbook that offered the protesters guidance on the do's and don'ts of confronting police and on behavior after arrest for civil disobedience or violence, property destruction, and other illegal acts. In Seattle, the resistance to the World Trade Organization, led by the ultra-left, tied the trade organization to global environmental abuse and social justice. Many protesters were dressed as sea turtles to draw attention to the alleged damage inflicted on turtles by WDO policies. The left's message in Seattle was quite clear: trade policy must have an environmental dimension because the environment is a global collective resource. According to one estimate, some 4,000 non-governmental organizations are active in environmental issues. Many are not focused exclusively on the environment, but include broader agendas such as women's issues, human rights, labor problems, and others. The larger non-governmental organizations like the Rainforest Action Network, RAN, and Greenpeace also peddle the radical left's progressive message. RAN activists take great pride in their radicalism and eagerness to resort to direct action. The latter boils down to an array of innovative stunts that shake down companies by painting them with bad public images. First, target companies receive a letter notifying that they have been selected as a target of RAN's Rainforest Protection Campaign. Second, companies make the evening news reporting the screaming antics of RAN protesters and their intimidation of employees and customers. Third, while still trying to deal with the bad publicity and anxiety of what comes next, a telephone call comes for an appointment with Randall Hayes, president of RAN. Fourth, Hayes makes an offer you can't refuse. The peaceable solution he places on the table is strict obeisance to RAN's demands. And finally, the target company agrees not to order from suppliers of rainforest products. Greenpeace, to borrow a phrase from Holland's investigative journalist Peter Seebelt, is a prominent member of the global Eco Nostra. Patrick Moore, a Greenpeace co-founder, described his former creation as being made up of a band of scientific illiterates who use Gestapo tactics. Susan George, director of the Transnational Institute, was on the board of Greenpeace International, 1990 to 1994. The secret to the success in making Greenpeace the largest environmental organization in the world, 5 million members and offices in more than 20 countries, is good management, creative direct mail, and keen image manipulation. After all, if one is concerned, at the very minimum, about the air he she breathes, water he she drinks, and the gas and oil he she consumes, which is everyone, Greenpeace is a wonderful organization. Direct mail propaganda sets up its members and prospective members with mindless, patently untrue claims, such as, "Don't believe it when President Bush and his administration suggest that, in the name of fighting terrorism, we have to tolerate the devastation of our environment or the elimination of our environmental laws." Your generous contribution to Greenpeace, Earth First, is a radical environmental coalition of neo-Marxists, anarchists, and other extremists that support anti-neoliberal objectives of the International Revolutionary Socialists. The group's logo is a green, clenched left fist, which is a recognized international communist symbol of solidarity. Earth First claims to be a warrior society, much in the same way that radical members of the Sioux Lakota Nation more realistically claim. Earth First members, in a grand romantic sweep, say that they will use any means necessary in defending Mother Earth. Rather than participate in the democratic process, Earth First prefers to commit assault, arson, sabotage, and other crimes of violence against farmers, ranchers, loggers, and others on their enemies list. The Mexico Solidarity Network is one of the most dedicated anti-capitalist groups, with members in North America and Europe. This ultra-left group stated its anti-capitalist agenda clearly in 2003 while protesting against the World Trade Organization's conference in Cancun. The corporate agenda implemented by the WTO pits worker against worker and nation against nation in a race to the bottom. On the opening day of the WTO ministerial meeting in Cancun, street workers challenged police lines, meeting batons, and tear gas, while a 56-year-old South Korean farmer activist died from a self-inflicted stabbing. Soon after, the WTO trade talks abruptly collapsed. The world's poorest nations erupted against the United States, European Union's countries, and other wealthy nations. The deep fissure separating the wealthy from the poorest members of the WTO rocked the international trade group. The poorest countries were adamant that global trade was tilted too heavily against them, which was driving some of the most vulnerable deeper into poverty. 10 months later, trade leaders met in Geneva to address the differences expressed at Cancun between rich and poor nations. There was no way during the four-day meeting to ignore the dark clouds threatening the World Trade Organization's viability. Since the WTO operates on consensus, the breakdown in Cancun was a major wrench in the trade group's machinery. The ultra-left was exhilarated by this turn of events. John Kavanaugh and Robin Broad of IPS, for example, celebrated by noting that India, Brazil, China, and nearly two dozen other poor nations, representing more than half of the globe's population, negotiated as a bloc. They rejected the meeting's final text, which was crafted to address the corporate interests of richer nations. Protest target, International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Flush with a victory in Seattle against the World Trade Organization, the ultra-left turned its attention to Washington, D.C. for demonstrations in April 2000 against the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank. The Mobilization for Global Justice, MGJ, served as the primary coordinator of the protests, teach-ins, lobbying, and other direct actions. For the ultra-left, the IMF and World Bank global rulemakers are akin to the World Trade Organization and international free trade agreements. The IMF and World Bank policies ensure open market access for corporations, the hard left's global exchange rails, while cutting social spending on programs such as education, health care, and production credits for poor farmers. If one can be persuaded through a constant din of radical left direct action and propaganda that transnational corporations, globalization, and capitalism are the root of all evil, one might believe such tripe. As is the case in all good propaganda, one can always find a bit of truth selected out of a mass of information that is molded by the clever Goebbelists on the left to fool us and take advantage of our lack of insight. Ralph Nader's April 2000 Multinational Monitor, for instance, depicted a skull atop the Lincoln Memorial on its front page, with World Bank and IMF in its eye sockets, and the headline, "Resist Corporate Dictatorship." Inside the cover, "Defund the Fund, Dump the Debt, Bankrupt the Bank," headlined the journal's April issue dedicated to the IMF on the run. A masterpiece of renewed Marxist propaganda and direct action, the Mobilization for Global Justice, April 2000 protest was drawn from the core of the ultra-leftists, Marxists, anarcho-communists, and anarcho-syndicalists. The new movement included the Institute for Policy Studies, Ruckus Society, Direct Action Network, 50 Years is Enough, Global Exchange, Rainforest Action Network, Friends of the Earth, Transnational Institute, Greenpeace, International Forum of Globalization, National Lawyers Guild, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and anarchist Chuck Munson and Luke Kuhn. Others would be added to this list over time. The major demand of those on the radical left was elimination of the debt amassed by developing countries in the South. Beside the debt forgiveness and IMF issues, analysts at the Malden Institute observed, Marxist groups are active in the protest, blasting capitalist institutions for seeking to create a world of landless laborers ripe for exploitation by the profit-hungry multinational corporations. The protesters gathered in Washington, D.C., intent on directing a reprise of their staggering victory in Seattle just 5 months previously. A similar result against the IMF and World Bank would have given a strong impetus to the ultra-left's worldwide movement against the growing global market economy, neoliberalism, and the ultra-left's propaganda parlance. In an effort to capture the spirit of Seattle in the protests against the IMF and World Bank, top leaders of the new movement were often the principal speakers at organizational meetings and press conferences. Among the lead speakers were Roger Newell, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Kevin Danaher, Global Exchange, former IPS fellow, and pro-Castro activist, Robert Neiman, Center for Economic and Policy Research and identified as having thrown a pie into the face of Robert Candesis, IMF Managing Director, at a February 2000 UN meeting in Bangkok, Robert Weissman of Ralph Nader's Essential Action, Nadine Block, known for creative protest tactics, and Soren Ambrose, 50 Years is Enough. More than 400 U.S. and international direct action organizations supported the anti-IMF protests. Among the groups were the Communist Party of the United States and of India, progressive entities serving as fronts for Marxist renewal and reemergence, and other left-wing organizations. Some of the main concerns were social justice, broadly defined, and economic justice issues, like fair trade coffee. This 20-something-year-old campaign promised benefits for low-income farmers and local businesses in the developing world. By 2005, the campaign boasted support from the hard-left Marxist Zapatistas in Mexico, Zapatista Coffee, building direct markets at fair prices for the products from the indigenous communities and resistance in Chiapas, Mexico, and the Catholic Relief Services in the United States. We know the people who sell us our coffee. We know the farmers who grow it. And we know our decision to buy fair trade coffee ensures they will earn a fair price and live with dignity. Neither organization provides the details on the large sums of money from the fair trade programs accruing to Dutch churches for their support of the long-standing Max Havelaar Fair Coffee program. Environmental justice was a hot topic in the late 1999 anti-WTO protest in Seattle and again in Washington, D.C. in April 2000. Friends of the Earth, FO, supported the anti-IMF and World Bank street action by alleging the two financial institutions failed to integrate environmental assessments in their policies prescribed for some of the world's poorest countries. Consequently, FO alleged, countries were often coerced to overexploit their natural resource base in efforts to earn foreign exchange that leads to pollution, environmental destruction, and non-sustainable exploitation of forestry and mining. Global Exchange, a well-funded, IPS-connected, anti-globalization mouthpiece declared, "We must make our demands for economic justice heard." Finance ministers from around the world will be in Washington to ratify their plans for the expansion of elite corporate power. The anarcho-communist bloc was unhappy with the Mobilization for Global Justice's plan, Peaceful Militant Direct Action, and its promise to avoid attacking property. The anti-authoritarian and anti-capitalist revolutionaries, including autonomists, anarchists, anti-state libertarian Marxists, and other radical groups, created the revolutionary anti-capitalist bloc. Despite their chest-thumping, menacing costumes, and chanting "Whose streets are streets," the Black Bloc was no match in confrontations with police. In the end, they coughed, sputtered, and mumbled something about the pepper spray used in Washington, D.C. being stronger than that sprayed in Seattle 5 months previously. The D.C. Metropolitan Police, U.S. Park Police, and a variety of other federal law enforcement agencies stunned the some 20,000 protesters in Washington by adopting what was essentially a small-scale version of Roman strategy. With the Roman Empire surrounded by hostile barbarian tribes, there was no way Rome could provide a perimeter defense of standing forces in the depth necessary to hold them at bay. Instead, the Rome built roads to facilitate rapid response by its army to meet challenges on its borders, engage, and defeat the barbarians. And then use the roads to return quickly to the empire's center in order to deter the other barbarians before they became aware that major units of Rome's army were out of position. The DC Metropolitan Police and their federal supporters did much the same thing. First, a large number of city blocks around the IMF/World Bank meeting site were barricaded, metal fences, and a thin line of police officers. Within the multi-street area blocked off was the Law Enforcement Nerve Center and a large number of mobile police. Once demonstrators surged on 17th Street, they were met with overwhelming force of horse-mounted police, motorcycle police, and police cars as far as one could see to the rear. Meanwhile, the thin blue line along the crowd control fence was thickened. The protesters, who had been in the process of working themselves into a rebellious lather, muttered and whined while they backed off. That became the main story of the April 2000 protest. The police outwitted and outmaneuvered the protesters at every corner. One could almost hear the heavy sound of wind going out of the demonstrators' sails. Later, one could hear anti-war marchers moaning about having nothing to do and being bored sitting around for hours on end waiting for the combat to begin. The rousing call to arms never came. In the end, the DC police had protesters milling about and muttering to themselves about law enforcement moves that neutralized their strategy and tactics. A big problem loomed for the demonstrators: how to get arrested. Such an arrest was a big battle star or merit badge, for being taken in by the police would give the protesters bragging rights, a demonstration of their resolve, and popularity with the opposite sex. The police would not cooperate and arrest them. In the end, the street workers negotiated their arrest by agreeing to cross police lines in an orderly manner. More than 400 protesters were accommodated by the DC's finest. Propaganda disseminated during the DC protests, agitprop, included the use of hand-carried signs, puppets large and small, banners, handbills, newspapers, magazines, pamphlets, books, internet reports, and photos of events on the scene. And topless women with propaganda messages scrawled on their breasts, a rather novel means of communication. Anti-capitalism, neo-Marxist, and international socialist revolution stood out as the predominant messages. Supporting themes included labor, farm, environmental, and anti-media corporate media is mind control propaganda. Largely because of the violent protest of an estimated 20,000 persons against the North America Free Trade Agreement in Quebec the week before. Only about 150 protesters showed up for the protests against the IMF and World Bank on April 29 to 29, 2001. Though few in number, the protesters on hand, including a handful of anarchists, picked up where the assembly left off the year before. The main theme was repeated: write off the debt of the poorest countries. World Bank President James Wolfensohn pointed out that $34 billion in debt relief for 22 countries had already been eliminated, with another $16 billion in the pipeline for another 17 countries. Marxism, a revisionist version first expressed by Italian communist Antonio Gramsci in the 1930s, dominated the September 27, 29, 2002 anti-IMF and World Bank protests in Washington, D.C. Through their anti-capitalist convergences, the anarcho-communist groups played strong roles in the planning and conduct of the direct action and propaganda that took place in the streets of the nation's capital. Influenced by the violent direct action tactics in Europe and Canada, and no doubt their burning resentment over the left's resounding defeat at the hands of law enforcement during the 2001 protests, planning included more widespread violence and mayhem than had been seen since the Battle for Seattle 3 years previously. A key to the success of these tactics was having a sufficient number of protesters to provide cover for the anarcho-communist blocs prior to the confrontation and to melt into the mass of demonstrators. An important aspect of disappearing into the mass was to ditch your black clothes completely or place them in a bag or backpack to avoid the police while heading for rendezvous points and safe houses. rumors were persistent that the International Direct Action Network of the People's Global Action, PGA, might dispatch key urban guerrilla units to Washington to lead challenges against law enforcement authorities. In the days leading up to the September 27th confrontation between urban guerrillas determined to shut down Washington, D.C., and the Metropolitan Police equally dedicated to frustrating the anarcho-communists, both sides prepared. Commuters were advised to avoid driving into the city on September 27th, and a fenced perimeter was established around the IMF and World Bank. How many protesters, with embedded anarcho-communists, would show up remained an open question. Although the police prepared for up to 20,000 by augmenting their ranks of 3,200 officers from nearby and some distant jurisdictions, commuters largely heeded the D.C. Metropolitan Police entreaties to avoid going to work or driving into the city on Friday, September 27. A brief delay occurred at about 8 a.m. on a major access bridge from Northern Virginia, and other interruptions occurred as a result of roving gangs of protesters blocking city streets. Windows were broken at a Citibank branch, and Class War was painted on a Bank of America branch. The anarcho-communist promise to shut down the city collapsed with timely counteractions by law enforcement. Police arrested 649 protesters, including 40 at Citibank, 20 at the Verizon building, and 200 were gathered up at Pershing Park, which was located inside the secured perimeter around the White House, IMF headquarters, and the World Bank main building after the protesters were encircled by police and herded into a tighter mass in order to isolate and ensure immediate quelling of any violence. Leads from the anti-capitalist convergence were quick to come. In a press release calling the police arrest an unprecedented attack of civil liberties, the anti-capitalist convergence quoted its member Ray Valentine, "These are frightening abuses of power," and signal the intent of police departments and the Bush administration to criminalize dissent, political activism, and public assembly. 40 an editorial in the Washington Times the day after the attempt to shut down the city. Perhaps best put the September 27th madness in perspective. What all this ruckus has to do with expressing sympathy for the world's poor in the alleged complicitous role of the World Bank and the IMF is hard to discern. The Mobilization for Global Justice's centerpiece protest march on September 28, 2002, fizzled when only about 3,000 to 5,000 demonstrators attended. The size of the central stage and audio system near the Washington Monument betrayed the left's expectations of a much larger crowd. Their numbers were nowhere near the 15,000 to 20,000 that had showed up April 2000. Many who may otherwise have been inclined to join the march were dissuaded by the confrontations and violence that had taken place the day before. The Mobilization for Global Justice issued a press release announcing that thousands descend on D.C. to prevent massive outbreak of social and environmental devastation led by the World Bank/IMF. The demonstrations were modest, with several anarcho-communists and mufti without their black garb, as well as communist labor organizers and other modern-day revisionist communists at the core of the march. Ralph Nader, for instance, accustomed to hiding behind Lori Wallach of the Global Trade Center, and Robert Weissman of Essential Action, gave a rousing speech about the great evils of corporatism, especially transnational companies. Laced with muted Marxism to maintain his progressive cover, Nader's words were in line with mainstream ultra-left propaganda. Nader, colleague, Robert Weissman, who serves as a co-director of Essential Action and an editor of Nader's multinational Monitor magazine, pounded home the notion of international corporate exploitation. The protest on Saturday, September 28, was replete with black and red anarchist flags, legal observers with the National Lawyers Guild, and a wide range of propaganda messages. One of the most unique tools was a 15-foot-long Trojan horse, indicating that World Bank aid was responsible for exploitation in the Global South. It had signs at its midsection to indicate the responsible powers: Citibank, Exxon, Halliburton, human rights abuse, global warming, and others. Handbills distributed at the protests covered a wide spectrum of issues. Following a long series of often violent protests against capitalism by the People's Global Action in Seattle, Prague, Ottawa, Genoa, and other locations, the International G8 meeting in Heiligdam on the Baltic coast of Germany took place on June 5 to 7, 2007. The politics of the 8 richest and most powerful countries in the world, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, and the United States, triggered massive protests. A big part for the G8's drawing power for the radical left protests is that the 8 members represented only 13% of the world's population, but they nevertheless addressed questions concerning the world economy, the environment, economic development, war and peace, and other issues of concern affecting all humankind. The People's Global Action resent the wealthy benefactors in the G8 countries as opposed to poverty elsewhere on the planet, the destruction of the environment in the name of profit, and the constant warfare on the earth either directly or indirectly involving the G8 countries. About 16,000 German police took on 100,000 G8 protesters who had assembled in Rostock, a city adjacent to Heiligendamm. More than 500 people were injured, many hospitalized, and a large number of arrests were made. Meanwhile, warships patrolled access from the sea. The communist and anarcho-communists turned out in large numbers with their red flags, some emblazoned with the hammer and sickle. "Death to capitalism, capitalism kills, I hate war, I hate capitalism," were among the propaganda placards and banners. The summit leaders themselves addressed climate change and means to achieve a global reduction of emissions, international problems in Kosovo, Iran, and Darfur, and Africa and AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. As for the anti-capitalist protesters, they were little more than a sideshow. True, they expressed their opposition to the G8 as an expression of globalization, but in the end they had little, if any, impact. Gary Smith, director of the American Academy think tank in Berlin, got it right. "What does it mean to be anti-globalization? It borders on nonsense." Ira Strauss, U.S. coordinator of the Committee on Eastern Europe and Russia and NATO, presented an excellent analysis of those who protest against the activities of the G8 and other free market fora. He was quite clear: they're against us for being capitalist. The protesters are delighted to break the law and disrupt government actions since they are opposed to our law and society to the very core. World Social Forum. "Another world is possible," exclaimed the World Social Forum's rallying cry against the policies of the North's free market democracies. On a second dimension, the forum's motto rallies the peoples in the developing world or the South who do not participate in the decisions of the World Trade Organization, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and G8, as well as regional economic pacts such as the European Union and Free Trade Area of the Americas. The World Social Forum began as a protest to serve as a counterweight to the World Economic Forum, a meeting of capitalist shakers and movers from the industrialized countries, including chief executives of the largest and most influential transnational corporations, academic supporters, or mercenaries in the eyes of the left, and government leaders of the free market democracies. Since 1971, the World Economic Forum has been called to order annually every January at the Swiss resort town of Davos, or occasionally at alternative sites. These conclaves typically would include discussion about major commercial issues associated with the global free market and the development of an economic agenda for the coming year. The first World Social Forum, also known as the Anti-Davos Conference, was held in January 2001 at Porto Alegre, Brazil, a city enjoying a robust left-wing government. The organizational spark for the birth of the forum was provided by Bernard Cassin, editor of Le Monde Diplomatique and the leader of ATTAC, a French anti-globalization group, and Brazilian grassroots organizations. Ranging from civil society groups and NGOs to political parties, churches, and unions, the idea for creation of the forum began in 1998 and accelerated when the protests in Seattle brought many more voices into a broad social movement opposing globalization. Cassin took advantage of the strategic moment by suggesting that a meeting at Porto Alegre would offer symbolic and direct opposition to global capitalism. While some 3,000 activists were invited to the 2001 World Social Forum, another 12,000 militants showed up for the plenary sessions, marches, informal meetings, seminars, and some 400 workshops on various topics. The overwhelming support for the World Social Forum at its maiden session was not accidental. Progressive socialist Marxists and communists, including parties, groups, and individuals, rushed to the World Social Forum to assert their leadership of the anti-globalist and anti-capitalist protest movement. The ultra-left's goals were twofold: promote Marxist analysis and discipline, and to contribute to building an anti-capitalist movement deeply inside the People's Global Action. Any doubts about the meaning of the anti-capitalist rhetoric pouring forth from the 2001 forum should have been swept away during the larger and more tightly organized second meeting a year later. Some 51,000 activists from 161 countries gathered in Porto Alegre in January-February 2002, about three times more than just a year before. The opening march by those attending was marked by a tumultuous sea of red flags, many emblazoned with the image of Cuban revolutionary Che Guevara. Thousands of red flags were carried by Marxist and Communist parties and labor unions, sending a clear message. Marxist renewal and reemergence was far more than a global slogan, especially in Latin America. The red flags were swelled in numbers by the homegrown Brazilian radical left, especially the Partido dos Trabalhadores, PT, Workers' Party, and the Movimento dos Trabalhadores Rurais Sem Terra, MST, Movement of Landless Rural Workers. The MST became notable for its direct action in support of 4 million landless families in Brazil, especially its seizing and working farmland held by absentee owners. Unsurprisingly, land reform through the redistribution of farmland was a central issue at the forum. The Institute for Policy Studies played a significant role at the 2002 forum meeting. Among the IPS officers, fellows, and associates were the IPS director, John Kavanaugh, Martha Honey and Sarah Anderson, IPS, Joshua Carliner, Executive Director of Corporate Watch and IPS spinoff, Susan George, a founder of World Social Forum through France's attack and director of TNI in Amsterdam, Martin Kaur, Third World Network, Lori Wallach, head of Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, Jokey and George Jehu, Executive Director of 50 Years is Enough, and Maude Barlow, a longtime Canadian radical, left activist and leader of the International Forum on Globalization, IFG. According to Canadian activist Naomi Klein, the IFG was created by IPS to serve as the brain trust of the North American side of the anti-globalist movement. Susan George, a longtime senior fellow and thinker activist of the Institute for Policy Studies in the Transnational Institute, placed the utopian goals of the World Social Forum into a distinctive anti-capitalist Western perspective. What we are doing at Porto Alegre is not building a new society for governments, nor a new society of nations. What we are building is a new society of societies. Emphasis added, Walden Bello, a longtime anti-corporate campaigner working with IPS and focus on the Global South, described the forum succinctly. There is no blueprint. We've had two blueprint disasters in the past 50 years, centralized socialism and corporate capitalism. We need something different. Fidel Castro's DGI, Intelligence Service, and Organization Continental Latino Americano de Estudiantes were active throughout the World Social Forum conclave, recruiting young activists from a number of countries. There were some 10,000 hard-knuckled militants, up from 1,000 the year before, for the Cubans to choose from. Among these attendees, including a large number from Latin America, were various brands of anarchists, Marxists, and communists, including veteran street fighters from Europe and a few from North America. Many of those at the forum's youth camp also were dedicated anti-capitalist activists from the People's Global Action. At the 2003 World Social Forum, about 100,000 radical leftists from 126 countries participated in the discussions, seminars, and other activities. About 5,000 anti-capitalist organizations attended, many from communist parties in Europe and Latin America. Some 200 of these communist contingents were from Cuba alone. French and Italian communists, anarcho-communists, and anarcho-syndicalists also were heavily represented. The youth camp numbered about 25,000 in a boiling cauldron of communists, Marxists, and anarchists. Street fighters from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Greece, Switzerland, Canada, and the United States mingled with representatives of Cuba's Young Communist League. The Transnational Institute exerted a strong influence on the Third World Social Forum, including a workshop on new politics, actors, strategies, and alternatives. The major topics addressed by TNI included a critique of democracies in Brazil, South Africa, and the United States, progressive national governments in the South, possibilities and limitations, and alternatives and new political thinking. Among the TNI leaders present at the 2003 World Social Forum gathering were the ever-present Susan George, the Marxist grandmother of WSF, Martin Kaur, Third World Network, Walden Bellow, Focus on the Global South, Tariq Ali, historian, Arundhati Roy, dissident from India, and Roger Burbach and Candido Grzyoski of the Brazilian iBase Group. The 2004 World Social Forum broke the mold of annual meetings in Porto Alegre by holding its fourth conclave in Mumbai, India. Incredibly, more than 150,000 participants from 130 countries supported the WSF's expansion into Asia. The self-appointed coordinators of the social movement emerged from the multitude of participants as peer-approved spokespersons for common points of view. While most subscribed to some form of Marxism and socialism, they were neither doctrinaire nor dogmatic about their position. This approach is basically consistent with Antonio Gramsci's revisionist Marxism, which emphasizes culture and filling open social spaces as steps leading toward a community-directed economy and government. In reality, it would seem that the direct action advocates gravitate toward the people's global action, while the World Social Forum appears more in line with people power, as expressed in Mumbai by former President of India, K.R. Narayanan. This movement is one of the most significant in history. To fight globalization, you need to fight the way Mahatma Gandhi fought with the strength of the masses. He was the first to show the way to nonviolence, and this has also been the method of this new movement. People's power is a new factor in international politics. Some 155,000 activists participated in the 2005 World Social Forum at Porto Alegre, Brazil, of whom 35,000 were crammed into the youth camp. Most of the 2,000-odd militants from the United States were associated with the World Social Forum movement or the People's Global Action. For highlights of the 2005 forum, underline the social movement's radical left-wing orientation and anti-American hatred. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez played the forum participants like a fine violin before, during, and after his address. When he arrived at the Porto Alegre airport, Chavez went directly to a 2,000-person settlement occupied by the landless workers' movement, which provides work for 37 families. He was dressed like a peasant farmer and wore a farm hat. Chavez, always the unabashed thespian, unbuttoned his shirt, exposing to the assembled farmers his t-shirt with the image of Che Guevara next to his heart. He was embraced and cheered, Hugo, campesino, and soldier. At the World Social Forum, Chavez spoke to a jam-packed audience in a local gymnasium. Participants had already been cheering whenever his name was mentioned. Beware, beware, beware imperialist, the entire Latin America will become socialist. Chavez's words enthralled the activists. It is time to take a step, and this fifth WSF could be the beginning of a new phase, and the next 5 years should be accompanied by a world socialist agenda, Chavez said. To that agenda, we must add a strategy of power. Another notable event was the presence of representatives from the United Nations. This was not the first time that the UN had been deeply involved in the activities of the hard left, anti-US World Social Forum conferences. In 2004, 8 UN agencies were listed as providing funding for the World Social Forum's anti-US and pro-ultra-left conclaves that fanned hatred of America, its president, and the American people. Members of the Socialist International also participated in a debate on reform of the UN and engaged activists and others present in discussion of outstanding issues. Some 60,000 to 70,000 people attended the 2006 World Social Forum held at Caracas, Venezuela. The gathering under the banner, Another World is Possible, attendees included liberals, progressives, socialists, neo-Marxists, communists, anarchists, unionists or syndicalists, and activists in support of various causes. Around 1,800 events were scheduled for the attendees by the some 2,000 non-governmental organizations representing various issues on the left-wing's menu for direct action and propaganda. 56 thematic issues addressed at the forum included power, politics and social emancipation, imperial strategies and people's resistance, diversity, identities and cosmovisions, worldviews, work, exploitation and reproduction of life, and communication, culture and education. 57 additional WSF meetings were held in Pakistan and Mali, with each of the three sessions focused on their particular economic, political, social, and cultural issues. The World Social Forum conference in Caracas was centered on the prospective integration in Latin America made possible by several countries moving toward the ultra-left. A summary perspective of the World Social Forum shows an open space concept that allows participants to organize their own activities. It is a horizontally structured network. This approach minimizes disputes and facilitates a dynamism of dialogue and collaboration. The forum's first principle, for example, interlinks groups and civil society movements that are opposed to capitalism and imperialism. The forum offers an open meeting place for reflective thinking, democratic debate of ideas, and interlinking for effective action. Anti-war. The Institute for Policy Studies has been a key player at the center of the radical left's anti-war campaign since September 2001. IPS refers to its opposition to the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq as being support for the peace movement in the service of justice. The Institute was co-governor of the session that created United for Peace and Justice, UFPEJ, in October 2002, which was to become one of the leading anti-war activist organizers of street protests. Amy Quinn, a veteran and excellent organizer, worked full-time on IPS anti-war activities and served on the board of the United for Peace and Justice Steering Committee. Before leaving for graduate school in 2005, she was especially helpful in coordinating the anti-war work of Military Family Speak Out and Iraq Veterans Against the War that operated within the broader IPS anti-war coalition. IPS tapped its long history in conducting such peace and justice campaigns, such as the Vietnam War, in seeking guidance for its contemporary anti-war leadership. But for the people at IPS, the war itself was less interesting than the opportunity it offered to denigrate the political and economic systems of the United States. The war opened an opportunity to advance IPS's progressive socialist Marxist revolutionary program for the transformation of American culture. It was not about the war on terrorism, but on political power. Former Marxist Ronald Radosh was very clear that even though the Vietnam War galvanized us and gave our lives meaning in reality, our intention was never so much to end the war as to use anti-war sentiment to create a new revolutionary socialist movement at home. The same is true for the progressive socialist Marxists in their intense post-9/11 anti-war protests. For them, the war against terrorism is a godsend, an opportunity to advance the agenda to transform American culture. The core of the street workers at the sometimes numerous 150,000 people anti-war protests in Washington, D.C., for instance, was made up of a tight knot of two mutually supporting left-wing coalitions: progressive socialist Marxists and the old left communists and anarcho-communists. Thousands of civilians, or non-ideological protesters, swelled the ranks of the hard left, who regarded them as being little more than dupes, dopes, and useful idiots. Many of the non-ideological street workers were simply people who, for one reason or another, were against the war. They did not know, or, if they did, they did not care that they were participating in radical left protests against the American way of life and government. The dupes multiplied the number of leftist street workers, and they became soft targets for harsh anti-U.S. propaganda and disinformation to reinforce their support. Two primary coalitions were formed to provide overlapping support for the anti-war movement. Not in Our Name, an ION, sponsored anti-war protests in the fall of 2002 and in several cities around the country. Some 70 members of the ultra-left signed the initial statement calling on the people of the U.S. to resist the policies and overall political direction that have emerged since September 11, 2001. Among the first to sign up were IPS associates and pro-communist Cuba advocate Medea Benjamin, Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange, Leslie Kagan, a founder of the Committees of Correspondence, a splinter of the Communist Party, USA, who also served as a co-chair of the IPS-sponsored United for Peace and Justice, and Noam Chomsky of the Committees of Correspondence, as well as a grab bag of Hollywood actors and ultra-left attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and other radical litigation fronts. The International Answer Coalition included anti-war, peace groups, faith-based communities, environmentalists, communists, Socialist Workers' Party, Communist Party, USA, Committees of Correspondence, Maoists, and Marxist-Leninists. A network of Arab and Arab-American groups, and it cooperated closely with IPS's Progressive Socialist Marxist Coalition. Medea Benjamin and Leslie Kagan created crosswalks between the two coalitions. Benjamin was a co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink, or Women for Peace, that had been pushing a Marxist agenda since the 1980s. The women-run, anti-war group works the halls of Congress and has handed out pink slips to those disagreeing with their calls for the ousting of President Bush. Gail Murphy, a Code Pink co-founder, explains that we're trying to change the culture and say, listen, these are not your hallowed halls of seclusion. Kagan, a longtime Communist Party activist, provided a bridge between the old left and the Gramsci Marxists promoting a stealthy culture transformation and accession to power by leftists. The birth of the Iraq anti-war movement began in January 2003, 3 months prior to U.S. military action against the bloody Saddam Hussein regime. Conception of the movement occurred at the Congress Against American Aggression on Iraq, which was held in Cairo, Egypt, on December 18 to 19, 2002. More than 400 activists, thought leaders, journalists, and agitprop organizers attended the Congress. Participants included those from 20 Islamic countries and several non-Arab countries, including Brazil, Cuba, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Russia, the United States, and Britain. Sadegh Hammoudi, Iraq's ambassador to the Arab League, said that U.S. aggression was interlinked with the globalization of capital investments. More Marx to Allah themes were included in the Cairo Declaration Against U.S. Hegemony and War on Iraq and in Solidarity with Palestine. Cairo Declaration. The Cairo meeting is not an isolated event, but an extension of a protracted international struggle against imperialism from Seattle and Genoa to Lisbon and Florence and Cordoba and Cairo. The U.S. provides unlimited support to the Zionist perpetrators of genocidal crimes against the Palestinian people. The suffering of the Iraqi people under a regime of genocidal sanctions lasting over a decade, and the aggressive militarism which they face today is but a logical outcome of the structures of power asymmetry of the existing world order. The U.S. monopolizes political, economic, and military power within the framework of capitalist globalization to the detriment of the lives of the majority of the world's people. The U.S. imposes control through naked aggression and militarized globalization in pursuit of its rulers' interests, all while reinstating the characteristic direct occupation of classical colonialism. The U.S. global strategy, which was formulated prior to September 11, 2001, aims to maintain the existing unipolar world order and to prevent the emergence of forces that would shift the balance of power towards multipolarity. The U.S. administration has exploited the tragic events of September 11th, under the pretext of fighting terrorism, to implement the pre-existing strategy. The Cairo Declaration is a rather stunning document. Not only did it denounce the United States in no uncertain terms, but its commentary reveals a fusion between the anti-globalization and anti-war activism. Secondly, it shows a fusion between international communism and Islamic extremism. And thirdly, it exposes a Marx to Allah linkage with Russia and its criticism of the unipolar world order and the need for multipolarity. This latter statement is straight out of Russia's Vladimir Putin's foreign policy commentary. The IPS-led anti-capitalist campaign that big business bought the government, reducing the average citizen to having a small voice in foreign policy, was intertwined with the anti-war message. Allegations of corporate war profiteering, creating a new national security state, and building a war economy to feed the corporate machine were at the center of much of the anti-war propaganda. This anti-war movement became a stunning progressive socialist Marxist schoolhouse to educate the non-ideological protesters. They might have been dupes, dopes, and useful idiots to the left, but they also represented tomorrow's voters who, when educated with appropriate anti-government propaganda, could be called upon to bring the left to power. IPS and its acolytes lost no time in seizing what they call this strategic moment to advance their Gramscian strategy toward political power. Robert Stacy McCain, an assistant national editor at the Washington Times, summed up the post-September 11 protest events well in an article entitled "Communists, Go Home." He pointed out the communist roots of the International Action Center and its anti-war front. Answer: as well as protest support from the Communist Party, USA, and the Maoist Group, the Revolutionary Communist Party, as well as the Ultra-Left Institute for Policy Studies and the National Lawyers Guild. McCain rightly concluded that, if all the communists were purged, there wouldn't be any movement left. Three protest groups showed up in Washington, D.C. on September 29, 2001, including the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, Anarcho-Communists, Peace Advocates from Oberlin University, and International Answer, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. The latter group was created after September 11th behind the curtains of the International Action Center, itself a front for the Workers' World Party, self-described as Marxist-Leninist. The Washington, D.C.-based Anti-Capitalist Convergence began in late morning, first assembling near the Capitol building at Freedom Plaza and then parading their anti-capitalist march against hate toward the White House, claiming that we are a movement devoted to social justice. The Anti-Capitalist Convergence announced, there is no justice to be found in retribution, war, racism, corporate globalization, or capitalism itself. Some 50 students from Oberlin College, Ohio, who had been recruited to attend the protest by their professors, arrived in Washington, D.C. to demonstrate for peace. They carried paper McHuman bodies like shields in front of them to symbolize the dead that would result from a U.S. attack against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. The students intermingled with the communist and anarchist protesters, swelling their numbers. When asked why the Oberlin students fell in with the hard left, one young woman replied, "Oh, we aren't political. We are for peace." The third group protesting on September 29th was International Answer, Stop War and End Racism. Announcing for a midday rally in Washington, D.C., the International Action Center's call to action stated, "While at this moment thousands of families are in mourning for the death and injuries of loved ones, the Bush administration is taking advantage of the tragic human toll to strengthen the forces of repression while intensifying the Pentagon's war drive, especially in the Middle East." John J. Tierney, faculty chairman and professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., best characterized the post 9/11 creation of the anti-war answer as being, "But the latest creation in a series of ruses that stretch back decades." Answer sponsored a large preemptive anti-war protest on January 18, 2003 in Washington, D.C., along with 19 other countries, most of them in Europe. Few Americans appeared to be aware that communist organizations were the ones supporting Saddam Hussein and opposing U.S. action against Iraq. The swarm of protesters in the nation's capital were primarily non-communists, and many brought their children to teach them the ways of democracy in action. Unwittingly, these demonstrators gave aid and support to the communist cause against the United States. An estimated 150,000 people showed up in Washington, D.C., and a similar number in San Francisco. Anti-war demonstrations in other U.S. cities were smaller but nonetheless sizable. An even greater anti-American enthusiasm surged in some 40 foreign cities. Neither the October 2002 nor January 2003 Washington, D.C. protests had anything to do with peace. They were all about tearing down the United States government and replacing its liberal democracy with an autocratic party-state arrangement similar to that in the former Soviet Union. It is not that these leftist agents of change did not learn from history. They are confident that they can step over the Kremlin's ideological errors and lead the United States to a borderless world of socialist governance. As the U.S. Congress prepared to debate the proposed 21,500 troop increase in Iraq, the surge in January 2007, tens of thousands of people demonstrated across the country. In Washington, D.C., the hard left was present in great numbers, and they were joined by celebrities, including Retread's Jane Fonda, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon, and Sean Penn, plus the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Representative Maxine Walters. Meanwhile, the co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus held a press conference on January 17th to announce the introduction of bills proposing a cutoff of funding and that would also compel military withdrawal from Iraq within 6 months. The core of the anti-war protests makes 3 points. 1. Communism is not dead after all. 2. Communism in America has some degree of reborn political traction. And 3. By operating together with the Progressive Socialist Marxist Coalition led by IPS's United for Peace and Justice, the ultra-left has exerted strong anti-war voices from the world's shadows. The non-ideological protesters allowed themselves to be used as cannon fodder for the extreme left. Not only were they used like so many streetwalkers, but they were betrayed by the far left and progressive socialist Marxist coalitions. For the Allah side of the Marx to Allah connection at the Iraq anti-war protest was the Progressive Muslims Network. Tariq Fatah explained that the members described themselves as progressive because they envision a society where wealth and its acquisition are not the sole and primary factors determining relationships between human beings and Muslims in particular. 74. The Muslim American Society's Freedom Foundation describes its focus as being engagement of American institutions and organizations in order to build a broad-based coalition that will enhance the religious, political, and social viability of the American Muslim community. 75. The Marx to Allah Brigade also served as speakers at the Washington, D.C. rally, including Mahdi Bray, Executive Director, Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation, Ashraf al-Bayami representing the December 2002 Cairo Congress, Ihab Darwish, Free Palestine Alliance, Ismail Kamal, Muslim Student Association, Ghazi Khan, Council on American-Islamic Relations CARE, Professor Hani Abdullah, and Imam Johan, Chaplain of Howard University. An Islamic literature table was open to those who might be interested. From the speaker's platform, U.S. Representative John Conyers, Jr., saluted his close associates, IPS co-founders Marcus Raskin and the now late Richard Barnett, who were unable to attend. Conyers also hailed supporters of Palestine and other Muslim groups and the Workers' World Party. On March 20, 2003, after President Bush announced the assault against the Saddam Hussein regime, tens of thousands of anti-war protesters were on the streets or at noon rallies in cities and college campuses or candlelight vigils in the evening. The most violent protests took place in San Francisco, where thousands blocked traffic at the entrance to the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge and Financial District. Some 300 protesters at one of San Francisco's federal buildings staged vomit-in by drinking a nauseating liquid and then barfing onto the sidewalks and plaza areas as commuters arrived. "War makes us sick" was the slogan in this rather innovative direct action and propaganda event. Nearly 200,000 anti-war protesters took to the streets in Manhattan on March 22. The March in New York, organized by longtime communists associated with United for Peace and Justice, stretched 20 abreast and 40 blocks long. Ultra-left groups, such as the Trotskyist Spartacist League, were also on hand pushing their particular brands of revolutionary socialism. While U.S. protests were underway, thousands more demonstrated across Europe, Asia, and Oceania. Many of the organizing groups were Marxists and revolutionary socialists, as well as people who for one reason or more held anti-American sentiments. European protests in sizable numbers were held in London, Paris, Madrid, Barcelona, Berlin, Lisbon, Stockholm, Dublin, Naples, Vienna, and Brussels. Demonstrations against the war took place in Afghanistan, India, Bangladesh, South Korea, and Japan. In Oceania, protesters took to the streets in Indonesia, Malaysia, Australia, and New Zealand. Having failed to prevent the Iraq War, the ultra-left turned to direct action agitation and propaganda to end the occupation of Iraq. The first major anti-war protest following the U.S. victory over Saddam Hussein occurred on October 25, 2003 in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and some 140 other cities across the United States and Canada. International Answer and United for Peace and Justice were once again the major mobilizers of hundreds of coalition partners who took to the streets. Their primary protest banners demanded an end to the occupation in Iraq, bring the troops home now, and the world unites against U.S. militarism. Answer made a major effort to encourage people of African descent to march on October 25. In addition, numerous Muslim organizations had joined International Answer's Coalition Against the War and Racism, including American Muslims for Global Peace, Muslims Against Racism and War, Muslim Student and Faculty Association, Alada Palestine Right of Return, Muslim Women's Political Action Committee, Editor of Arab Journal, Muslim Student Union, and others. The coalition partnership between the World Workers' Party behind ANSWR and numerous Muslim associations suggests once again that a strong Marx-to-Allah bond has been formed inside the United States. Direct action agitation and propaganda was quite coarse in many cases and developed new themes. A major spin-off of the Institute for Policy Studies, the Institute for Southern Studies, carried the IPS propaganda line. A second invasion has begun of powerful corporations who seek to reap billions in profits from the devastation of war, and who aim to seize the wealth and resources of the Iraqi people. Southern Studies continued its anti-corporation diatribe, alleging, without a shred of evidence or a single supporting anecdote, that through multi-billion-dollar reconstruction contracts, a handful of well-connected, mostly U.S. corporations, many with scandal-ridden business records, are making hundreds of millions in war profits. The next large turnout for a communist-organized anti-war protest occurred on April 24, 2005. Express metro trains from Northern Virginia were packed with demonstrators, many of whom were oblivious to the ultra-left's agenda. Their ages were from teenagers to seniors, and many protesters brought their children. The Federal Triangle Metro stop was the destination for most, referred to as the Federal Crime Center, by several protesters. In addition to sizable numbers of locals attending the protest, large numbers of anti-war demonstrators poured into Washington, D.C. from locations the east of the Mississippi River. Meanwhile, protests were also taking place in San Francisco, Seattle, and other cities. Anti-war demonstrators adopted a new propaganda line as a rallying cry following the devastation along the Gulf Coast by Hurricane Katrina, from Iraq to New Orleans, fund human needs, not the war machine. Once again, the Communist International ANSWR and United for Peace and Justice took the lead in organizing the protest. Other ultra-left groups joined the Marxist cabal, including Code Pink, MoveOn.org, and Veterans for Peace. The Mobilization for Global Justice conducted a small protest against the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Bill Dobbs, spokesman for United for Peace and Justice, told journalists that the message was simple: end the war in Iraq. Bring them home now. The hard left's queen of the anti-war protest was Cindy Sheehan, mother of a soldier killed in Iraq. For whatever personal reasons, she buried her son and then became a communist-supporting hater of America, performing her role well whether she was hugging Venezuela's Hugo Chavez or camping out in front of President George Bush's home in Texas. The radical left's Code Pink raised money for her anti-war propaganda, and the communist-led MoveOn.org used her in its anti-American ads. The anti-war coalition organized by ANSWR held a series of protest events, September 22 to 28, 2007, to demand that Congress cut off all war funding. A preemptive move against the expected testimony of General David H. Petraeus on the surge strategy revealed the extreme left's strategic purpose to work with its partner, the Progressive Socialist Marxist Coalition led by the IPS-sponsored United for Peace and Justice. Some 100,000 protesters marched from Lafayette Park across from the White House to the Capitol lawn, where they attempted to hold a die-in. Numerous protesters, about 165, were arrested for jumping over police barriers. The U.S. Marxist-Leninist organization was very pessimistic. The failed U.S. state refuses to meet the people's just demands to end the war now and bring all the troops home. On every front, it has abandoned all social responsibility. The sad part about the radical left's lies and deceit over the Iraq War was that it led good, patriotic Americans to false conclusions. Not only that, but the left turned them into anti-democratic activists against the United States way of life. As Americans, we are supposed to collect all of the facts, decide on the appropriate direction for the government leading us, and take actions through the ballot box, letter writing, or even protests to make our will be known. We must be clearly informed. Many of the non-ideological Iraq war protesters were lied to, manipulated, and turned into dupes, dopes, and useful idiots by the Institute for Policy Studies and its Progressive Socialist Marxist shining stars in its solar system of organizations. Betrayal of people's goodwill is a vile political action, and that is exactly the path taken by the radical left. Blinded by the sunlight outside of Plato's cave, these hapless Americans became street workers for the left. They simply could not see the truth. We have long warned that the peace movement is not about peace, former Marxist-Leninist and new leftist David Horowitz intoned in March 2003, that it is a fifth-column communist movement to destroy America and give victory to our totalitarian enemies.